Talk Radio 1230 KJFK now presents Happy Talk, hosted by Michelle Happy. Happy Talk is heard the last Sunday of every month from 9 to 10 a.m.
It's pretty fascinating to hear about other people's stuff. I mean, it's fascinating to me. And, you know, I think most people are pretty interested in, you know, sort of the disorders that we live with that make us the walking wounded. It's really easy with the way things are going now to turn to substances to try to soothe our angst. If we have any emotional disorders, those tend to blossom under stress. So now is a really good time to be hearing about this stuff. People are fascinating, and the human spirit is amazing.
Michelle is licensed in the state of Nevada as an addictions therapist, and she'll talk with you about just about anything. Give her a call at 825-7529. Now, here's your host, Michelle Happy.
Good morning. It's Michelle Happy here with Happy Talk. I was listening to the news while I was supposed to be talking, so that's the way it goes on this show. We're casual here. I think we're going to have fun today. I've got Ed Lynn, MD, with me today. He's a psychiatrist, and we're going to be talking psychiatry. And Maggie Link is also here. She's here every time. Maggie, you're only going to be here till about 9:30, right?
Correct. Okay. Right.
Ed, welcome.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Good to be here.
Yeah.
Good to have you here. Just some housekeeping. If I'd love to get some phone calls. So first of all, if you're listening to the show and you know people who are interested in the subjects that we talk about, give your friends a call, have them tune in. If you're too shy to call in, you can email me from my website, mhappy.com. It's H-A-P-P-E, so it's mhappe.com. And I've got my iPhone here with me, and I can take your email questions for Dr. Lynn or for Maggie or myself. And let's see, what else do we need to talk about? I think that's it for housekeeping. As we go along, I'll probably add some other stuff. Maggie, I know you had a question for Ed.
Yes, actually, Ed, I just wanted to get some clarification on, as a psychiatrist, what the difference is in being a psychiatrist versus a therapist.
Well, there are all sorts of therapists at different levels, in social work, pastoral counseling, psychology, nursing, and medicine. A psychiatrist is a person, in my own case, you go to medical school first, and after 4 years of medical school, I spent a year in training in internal medicine, and then 3 years of training in psychiatry, which involved hospital psychiatry, outpatient, emergency room, psychotherapy, individual, family, group, couple work, and also doing physical evaluations and also using medications for different mental disorders. So a psychiatrist is a physician who specializes in disorders of behavior, mood, feelings, thought, like that. Mm-hmm.
It sounds a little different than the psychiatrist today. You know, you had all this emphasis on more therapy kinds of activities.
Well, Michelle, I trained so many years ago that we only had about three or four drugs to poison people's brains with.
Right. So how has it changed?
I'd say about 90-95% of my training was in psychotherapy. I think nowadays it's become more biochemical. There's less training for trainees in psychiatry and the psychotherapies and more in the biological aspects of mental disorders.
So like the way I use psychiatrists, and I use you for many years until you retired, and I'm really angry at you for retiring because he was such a great person to refer to, where I do the therapy and with my relationship with you, you would do the medication issues.
Yeah, split therapy is quite common nowadays, whether it be a psychotherapist of whatever discipline and a psychiatrist prescribing or a family physician or an internist sometimes prescribing for the therapist. The problem with split therapy, and we didn't have that because we used to get together once a week for lunch and gossip about the patients we shared, so we were keeping in touch with one another and on the same page. But very often when the split therapy, the practitioners don't communicate with one another very often, if at all.
Yeah, I was trained in Los Angeles, and I was trained on teamwork. And when I came to Nevada, it was like, I don't think these people know about teamwork. It's very important if you want to deliver good care to the client.
And it's also time-consuming. Mm-hmm. And you really have to pay attention to that. And often practitioners on either side of the split therapy don't have the time to communicate.
Right.
You know, you play telephone tag with busy practitioners, and you know, it takes days before you can get one another on the phone.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's true. And you and I have been having lunch together since 1993.
Yeah. And we still do today, even though I'm retired.
Yeah. Well, you know, we've kind of become friends
We got into the habit.
So, Ed, tell me, how did you pick that specialty? I mean, you were becoming a doctor. Did you have another idea at first?
I certainly did. I was a very early decider. Typically, early deciders come from families where there are physicians. There were none in my family. I think I was the first person in my family to go past high school. But we had a family doctor. I remember Gabriel Kirschenbaum. He was a 6.5 foot tall Brooklyn physician who wore a 10-gallon hat. And he was just a great man. So I always thought about medicine. And the story is that when I was 5, my dad took me to a toy store to have anything I wanted for my 5th birthday. And I immediately walked over and got my little doctor bag. Now, in retrospect, it may have been because I knew the pills were candy inside the bag. So that may have been one of the reasons. But medicine was always in my mind throughout my training.
So if I'm going to interrupt you for a sec, if I could get all Buddhist on you, maybe you did medicine in past lives.
Oh, one might speculate that.
Okay, so medicine. Then what was next?
Well, we didn't – in medical school at that time, there weren't any departments of family practice. In fact, in many of the more academic institutions, the family practitioner was kind of looked down on. Mm-hmm. So the next best thing, and one of the strongest departments in our medical school was internal medicine. The other was psychiatry. I was heading for internal medicine. In fact, I was really ambivalent because I really like psychiatry. Because I think the students are treated more humanely there than in any other specialty. And so in my elective 6-month period, I split it between radiology and psychiatry. So it tells you how ambivalent I was. So after 1 year, I decided I saw the light and I made a move towards psychiatry.
Yeah. You know, it's time to take a break. It may seem that it's foreshortened. That's for a reason, because the Giants are playing today. So we have until 10 till to talk. So let's take a break.
Welcome back to Happy Talk here on Talk Radio 1230 KJFK with your host, Michelle Happy. The phone lines are open for you to join the conversation at 825-7529. Now, here's Michelle.
So we're back, and welcome back. Please do call if you have any kind of questions about psychiatry, addiction. We'll be getting more into the meat of it. It's 825-7529. Give us a call, or you can email me. Just go to mhappy.com, H-A-P-P-E. So back to Dr. Lynn, or Ed, as I call him. So you decided on psychiatry pretty early.
Yes, I did.
Okay. And then so how after you were done with school, how did you get set up in your practice?
My first position was as a full-time academic at a brand-new medical school at Michigan State University. It was the first community-based medical school in the country, and it was a chance for some pioneering effort in creating new programming. I was there for about 6 years as a teacher, researcher, administrator, and then came here in 75 to join the medical school at UNR and to start a mental health program at the VA hospital in Reno.
So you've been in Reno for a long time.
Yes, I have.
But you practiced in Carson City.
I did.
Why did you decide to go to Carson?
After I left the medical school in 86, there was an opportunity to be a medical director of a small mental health program at Carson Tahoe Hospital and create a private practice. And I thought I'd start practicing what I preached.
That's great. And now that he's left Carson City, there's hardly anybody there aren't many psychiatrists around.
Apparently not.
Yeah. There's a dearth. I think we have someone on the line.
Yeah.
Is that true? Oh, he's on the phone, so we'll get with them in a second. Yes, Maggie.
I actually, just to get more on the topic of medications, because one of the questions I had was in regards to antidepressants. And I know that's kind of a general question. I don't know if you can answer it in general on all antidepressants or if it's kind of each medication on its own. But I have a friend that was just prescribed antidepressants. And kind of the debate I've heard is they can be have a lot of negative side effects. So kind of wanting to get some perspective on, I guess, the pros and cons.
Well, it's always a cost-benefit analysis when using medication, and I don't think there are any medications that are side effect-free. So you have to weigh these kinds of issues. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's interesting. I think a lot of people are undiagnosed who could probably benefit from medication, like antidepressants. Plus, there are a lot of people, I think, who are on antidepressants who probably don't need to be on antidepressants. So making sure that there's an actual need and the drugs are prescribed with follow-up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes the primary care physicians might prescribe medication to a person in need of an antidepressant, but there's very little follow-up. And I think one has to let patients know what side effects to expect.
Right.
And also be on top of those.
Right. And that's where follow-up, like when I would send you somebody, I would follow up. I would always ask, how are you doing? Are you having any side effects? You know, you get an awareness of sort of what to expect. And then if there was troubles, I would just say, well, give Dr. Lynn a call.
Well, and I think, too, with obviously technology, there's a lot of information people can look on the internet and find side effects, too, as well.
So. Patients are awfully sophisticated
right,
nowadays.
Right,
you know,
right. It's not always the best information.
In the old days, it used to be real secretive,
credible.
But now you can just
right.
about Google anything and know as much, if not more, sometimes than the practitioner about something.
Hey, we've got a couple calls. On line one, we have, I think it's somebody who wants to be anonymous because I have R. Hi, how are you?
Oh, good morning. How are you?
Good, good. Do you have psychiatry questions?
Well, I'm the question is about how fragile sobriety is.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that the truth?
I've this time around, I've been sober for a little over 4 years.
Mm-hmm. Congratulations.
And, well, thank you very much. But you know, the truth is, you know, as we say in the program that I'm in, that, you know, we're just sober today.
Mm-hmm. Have the one day.
It's when I think about it sometimes, it is really the fear of my life to the point where I can't, you know, I really, there's a lot of things to be scared of, but this, you know, this one is large enough that it is really the fear. And, you know, you hear the stories. People, 30 years of sobriety, good sobriety.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You know, and then they go out, and in 6 months they're dead.
You know, there's a phrase in, I think, that program that you're referring to that says the farther you are from the last drink, the closer you are to your next.
And that's terrifying.
And, you know, the fear that you have will keep you sober. Most likely, because you do not want to lose your sobriety. But it's a good practice to try to moderate that fear so you don't live in anxiety and have to go to a psychiatrist and get anti-anxiety meds. So are you on medication at all?
No, ma'am.
Okay.
It's interesting because I'm also not as a patient. I'm involved with NAMI of Northern Nevada
mm-hmm.
as a volunteer and It's just something I fell into. A lot of those people are on medications, and it's very, very important for them to stay on their medications.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I don't feel that that I should be on a medication.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I have ambivalent feelings about everything. You know, you are a Buddhist. My worldview is not necessarily somebody that believes in a personal God. You know, I love to go to the meetings and I love to hang out with those people and I love to look at the faces of sober alcoholics and I get a lot of strength from that. On the other view, I really, if I was to tell the truth, I don't believe it. You know, I don't believe in this personal God.
Right, right.
You know?
And that's, boy, we could talk for a long time about that.
Yes,
yeah.
That's one of the things that keeps a lot of people from going to the 12-step programs is
right.
having an atheistic point of view. Mm-hmm.
I didn't say atheistic.
Believing in something different. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, uh-huh. But, you know, I would like to point out, you know, the first step says, you know, you just have to... You have to admit you're an alcoholic, and the third tradition says the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. And
mm-hmm.
I would tell anybody that is either an agnostic, atheist, Buddhist, Taoist,
whatever,
don't let that, you know, nobody's going to kick you out.
That's a great point.
You know,
yeah.
I don't even really know what my point is here, to tell you the truth.
I just wanted to say hi. You don't have any questions for Dr. Lynn?
Well, the question is the fragility of the whole thing, you know, is there any hope in the future? And this is a shocking thing that I would, you know, that I would never bring up in a meeting. Is there hope in the future for a actual cure for alcoholism?
That's a great question.
You want to respond?
Well, you know, I've been treating alcoholics probably since 1965. First, I'd like to congratulate you on your 4 years of sobriety. I'm also a member of NAMI, so again, I understand the power of that group.
Oh, it's a wonderful group.
Oh, absolutely. One of the issues for me with patients of mine who've had difficulties in accepting a higher power is I've always said, you know, maybe the group can be your higher power. It doesn't
right.
have to be an entity or a deity.
Mm-hmm. Drunks.
Yes.
Whatever it means to you.
And, you know, one of the things in addition to a 12-step approach to recovery, I had Ed Lynn's one-step approach, and that was not only admitting that you're an alcoholic, but getting that it's perfectly okay to be an alcoholic. Mm-hmm. It's not okay to drink.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that also has to be okay is your fragility. You know, okay, so I'm fragile regarding my sobriety, and one has to just accept that.
Mm-hmm.
Whether or not there'll be a cure for alcoholism, one can only hope. There's all sorts of, you know, genetic manipulation that's been going on now with a number of disorders. I would stay open to that and hopeful about the possibility of a cure.
And the big thing are, we're getting ready for a break here, but the big thing is just to remember the gratitude for being sober. And I know you know that. And I want to thank you so much for calling.
Yeah,
in.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Sure thing. We'll get to our next call after the break.
Welcome back to Happy Talk, here on Talk Radio 1230 KJFK, with your host, Michelle Happy. The phone lines are open for you to join the conversation at 825-7529. Now, here's Michelle.
And we're back, and we have another caller for either me or Dr. Lynn or both of us. Darlene, line two, how are you?
Good morning. Wonderful. Good. And you?
I'm doing good. Well.
Good, good. Well, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question's for Dr. Lynn. I'll try not to make it lengthy. Doctor, recently, about 12 years ago, bipolar I was told about, and then I've been fighting it for all these years, and about 3 weeks ago I got back from a recovery place, and now it's bipolar, ADHD, PTSD, and borderline personality disorder. So aside from being really frustrating, I'm working on getting the right recipes to manage all these things. And maybe it's because I'm more more aware of it. I think I might be focusing too much on all these things, but would you agree that it's important to identify, let's say, the difference between mania or the world is hopeless and my whole world come to an end, so I can identify each individual issue? What do you think?
It's a good question, John.
Well,
he's not going to be treating you personally. You're going to be speaking in general.
Yeah, and I've had a number of patients with what I call alphabet soup diagnoses, including they wear BVDs in addition to ADD. And it's really difficult. I think number one is if indeed you're in recovery. I gather you said you're in recovery program.
Well, yeah, I went away the other part of it. I went away for the month and decided, I never decided to give up my Cabernet. I was going to ask you about that too. You know, while having a cocktail responsibly, not turning into the town drunk, you know.
Well, you know, there's some difficulties. I think there are some different feelings about that. My own personal one is I think sobriety is key in terms of dealing with all the other stuff. And that sometimes has to be number one. One of the problems with alcohol, and I do drink occasionally, I think it's nice to get a little bit of an alcohol buzz. The problem with alcohol, it's a mood distabler. Alcohol is a central nervous system depressant. And it could also interfere with sleep. And many of us who may have mental disorders have sleep difficulties, and that could be a problem. So if we're depressed, it's depressing. Some people who have bipolar disorder tend to drink more when they're high, hypomanic, or full manic. So alcohol can affect, you know, trying to regulate mood. It can also interfere with some of the medications that we might prescribe to stabilize someone. So it's something to consider. And if indeed you're truly fully bipolar, I think bipolarity has to be taken care of. The stability helps with sobriety. Sobriety helps with stability. So it's a matter of balancing everything together.
Yeah, that is what I was told, was that unless the bipolar got regulated, if it did get regulated, then I wouldn't want to be catching a buzz.
That's a possibility. You know, sometimes we drink because we're down. And unfortunately, when we're down a drink, we get further down.
Yeah.
You know, it's a balance. And, you know, one of the things you might kind of consider, I often tell people to consider maybe staying abstinent for like 30 days and see if that makes a difference in how your mood goes. It also may make a difference if indeed you have ADHD. It may make a difference in how your thinking goes. So, it's a matter of trying these things out.
And with all of these diagnoses that you have, there's probably many medications that can be used. So you're an advocate of doing one at a time.
Yeah, I think if you start more than one drug at a time and you have bad result, you don't know what's causing it and you have to stop everything. So I think stabilizing mood is first.
Okay.
Patients that I've had, and it's quite common to have people who are bipolar and ADHD, is to stabilize the mood first before you start tackling the ADD problem.
And stabilizing the mood, and you're speaking of mood stabilizers, there are medications that do that
yes.
specifically treat mania, right?
Well, actually, some of them help with both, but they do tend to reduce the high peaks. Mm-hmm. Lithium being the very first one. I remember being involved with research in lithium back in the 60s, in the mid to late 60s, before it was FDA approved. That was the first one we had to help balance things out. There are other medications now.
Primarily what do you think of lithium, Doc?
I'm sorry?
What do you think of lithium? That's something new I'm...
Lithium has been the oldest, tried and true, the one I grew up with. I've been prescribing it since, like, you know, 1967, 68. And that often is a first line for me personally because I'm so familiar with it and I know how to handle it, and it's easy to teach patients how to adjust it. And again, you have to worry about side effects with lithium as well as anything else.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's a little cleaner than some of the other medications and certainly a lot less expensive.
Well, that's the truth. Yeah,
yeah.
$6. Hey, Doc, may I ask you one more question?
Please.
Your thoughts.
Uh-huh.
The use of cannabis,
mm-hmm.
you know, marijuana?
Yes.
And for bipolar, for the ADHD, not all day smoking, but say responsibly at the end of the evening, and it seems to work when other things don't, and it's sort of kind of slow down.
Well, it can. You know, before there were prohibitions about marijuana, it was recommended for about 10 or a dozen different disorders by the American Medical Association before it became illegal. I've never seen any major research that suggests for the vast majority of bipolar patients that it's of use. I've known some depressed patients who seem to feel better. And yes, some people who have hyperactivity tend to slow down a little bit with marijuana. I think one needs to go cautiously with that in terms of obtaining it. It's still illegal in some parts of the world. The Marinol, which is kind of the medical extract, can be prescribed in Nevada, but it doesn't have the same effect that regular cannabis does. So,
and marijuana does tend to enhance whatever it is we're feeling. Isn't that right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, I kind of, before introducing that, I think, you know, again, stabilizing the mood swings and maybe abstaining from alcohol would be something to consider first.
Only 30 days, Darlene.
Another 30 years.
Yeah, it feels like a lot of time.
Darlene, thanks so much for your question.
Yeah. I appreciate
for
your time and input. Thank you so much.
Sure thing. And it's time to take a break.
Welcome back to Happy Talk here on Talk Radio 1230 KJFK with your host, Michelle Happy. The phone lines are open for you to join the conversation at 825-7529. Now, here's Michelle.
Welcome back. We're playing Stump the Shrink with Dr. Ed Lynn. And that was a great call from Darlene. Thanks so much. I think we have another call. No, we do not. Okay. I see the board blinking, and I'm kind of new at this, so bear with me. I want to do a little bit of housekeeping. You notice during the breaks there are ads, and I am looking for sponsors. It's actually financially very reasonable, and you get one of those ads that you heard. That's a 60-second ad fully produced here at the station. So if you're interested in being a sponsor on the show, you can email me or give me a call, and we can get started on that. Also, Maggie has left. She has another job she had to do. Maggie interns for me, and thanks to her, I'm able to offer low-cost therapy for people, which is important to both of us because today, with the way insurance is, it's really hard to be able to afford therapy. So if you're in need of therapy and don't have much money, give us a call and we'll try to work something out with you. So back to Ed. You know, you brought a really interesting, where did you get that? It's a little clipping.
It was from a LA magazine that I was reading when I was working out at the gym the other day, and I decided to clip it.
It's kind of stunning. This represents how much money is being spent on antidepressants. You want to just go over that?
Well, a couple of interesting items. The number of us in America who were prescribed antidepressants back in 96 was about 13 million. By 2005, it more than doubled to 27 million. Now, the amount spent on direct-to-consumer antidepressant advertising, that's the stuff you see on TV all the time, in 99 was $32 million. By 2005, it rose to $122 million that the pharmaceutical industry spends just on direct advertising to us. It's estimated that 15 million of us suffer from major depression in 2008. This is according to the National Institute of Mental Health. And about $10 billion are spent on antidepressant medications. This is back in 2009. But I have to also add that, you know, major depression is a devastating illness, and it does warrant, in many cases, the use of antidepressants. But antidepressants also have usefulness in OCD, obsessive compulsive mm-hmm. disorder, a generalized anxiety disorder, and panic disorder.
Absolutely. It's amazing. You know, I think I'm also a very political person. I think we really need to get the money out of a lot of things. And Big Pharma is a huge lobby. And that's a lot of money. And this direct advertising seems very wacky to me because don't your clients come in and say, I want this because I saw this ad?
Absolutely. You know, what's interesting to me is right after a big pharma ad, there's an ad by some law firm that says, if you have had a child who had a birth defect and you were on Zoloft or Paxil or some other antidepressant, call this 1-800 number.
Absolutely.
So
it's a wacky world.
It is indeed.
We have a call from Kevin on line one. Kevin, how are you? Oops, having trouble hearing you. There you are.
Yes.
Hello.
Hello. My question regards the use of lithium. My ex-wife certainly had to use a mood-changing preparation, and she was also very active with her various automobiles. You would never stop that woman from driving, as far as I know, in any possible way. There was no law that could be created to stop her from driving. Now, did the lithium, and this is such a strange question that I'm wondering now, does the state of Nevada stop the use of lithium, people driving, or are there insurance company prohibitions against that? Well, I suppose there are, but I'm just wondering if it's still useful as a drug, because it certainly helped my ex-wife.
Thanks, Kevin. Lithium certainly is quite useful, and it's still being prescribed. There's no prohibition for people who are on lithium to drive. So it does not affect your ability to drive, especially if it's used in appropriate doses. Airline pilots can't be on lithium in pilot, but they can't be on almost any other drug either. But there's no prohibition, and it doesn't interfere with driving. In fact, for people who have bipolar disorder, it might improve their driving because they're not taking chances when they're high, and they're paying better attention because they're not getting low. So I certainly see no problem with it.
Yeah, that could have been a little breakthrough mania on the high side.
Exactly.
Driving issue.
So yes.
It's a matter of getting the right dosage and having close contact with your doctor.
Exactly.
Well, I have an allied question to that, if you have time, Doctor.
Please.
And that is, she did have a blood pressure problem, meaning a slightly higher systolic pressure, I don't know, 130, something like that. Mm-hmm. And with the drugs that are available today, like prazosin and so on, are they compatible with lithium?
The only issue that I could see, someone who is hypertensive, who's on lithium, if they are put on a diuretic, the diuretic can cause an elevation in blood lithium, and they can get up to dangerous levels. So that has to be monitored. Other than that, I don't see a problem.
Well, thank you very much.
You're most welcome. Thanks for the question, Kevin.
Thanks for your call, Kevin. And we have an email question for you here on my iPhone. This person says, I recently read a book, Lonely, Learning to Live with Solitude by Emily White. And has Dr. Lynn heard of it and his thoughts about loneliness as an actual chronic condition versus depression?
I'm sad to say I don't know the book. It sounds like an interesting one to read. There's, I think, a difference from being lonely and being alone. Some people choose to be alone. There are hermits among us and people who are quite introverted. There are also people who choose to be isolated and alone because they're depressed and they don't have any energy or don't want to be among other people. There are people who are alone because they may have social anxiety disorder and they feel real anxious being out and about, may have severe agoraphobia. They're just afraid of being out there at all. And there are some people who are quite comfortable with their being alone. Nowadays, people are connected to all sorts of social networks on the internet, and they feel much more comfortable in their aloneness. So I think there are all types and sizes in the alone business.
And, I also think that if you are depressed, you will feel loneliness. I think what happens when we're depressed is, we just feel different from everybody else. It's kind of like walking around in syrup. Everything can get slowed down. And people who are depressed tend to isolate. So, that's another thing to consider.
Yes, it is.
So if you're having loneliness issues, it's a good idea you can take a test to see if you're depressed. And you can find that test on my website, mhappy.com. It's called the Goldberg Depression Test, which will give you a numeric value for whether or not you are suffering from depression. If you're not depressed and you're lonely, then it's time to get out and do some stuff to mingle with, I always recommend, with members of your tribe. You know, if you're an introvert, to mingle with fellow introverts, because we do kind of get each other. And I am an introvert. I know Dr. Lynn here is an extrovert. So
I've been accused of such. But I would also add, Michelle, that if you are depressed and lonely, it's time to get out, because isolating deepens the depression.
And thanks so much for that question. Hey, Ed, we're going to have you back. This was a really interesting show. I want to thank everybody for their calls. And we'll be seeing you in a month, the last Sunday of the month, in 4 weeks. Thanks for being here. Be well.
You've been listening to Happy Talk, heard the last Sunday of every month from 9 to 10 a.m. with your host, Michelle Happy. Find Michelle online at mhappy.com. Happy is spelled H-A-P-P-E. Join us again the last Sunday of every month at 9 a.m. Diane Underwood and Reverse Aging will be back next Sunday at 9 here on Talk Radio 1230 KJFK Reno, a service of Americom Broadcasting.